Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to episode 28 of the Footmarks podcast. I'm your host, Behram Kazi, and with me, as always, is Jared Kimber. You can find me at DefMango on Twitter, and you can find Jared everywhere. So, the episode, the title of today's episode is How Did They Lose That? Which is a pun on Fazeer Muhammad's commentary when Pakistan defeated the West Indies all those years ago. The final miss you test. But basically, we're going to talk about the World Cup final and how India managed to lose that, really. And there are a bunch of reasons over here. But I'd just like to start off, Jared, by saying that India played their World Cup opener versus Australia, you know, and then they faced nine other teams. And then they faced Australia again in the final. So would you say that the Australian team that they met in the final had evolved from the unit that they beat in Chennai, you know, nine games ago?
This show was brought to you by HCL Tech, leaders in data and technology, and you can see their names right there on the sleeve of the Australian team.
Yeah, it's funny. Some of the Australians were saying, you know, no one believed in us and everything. The Australian team wasn't believing in themselves like early in that tournament. So I don't think we can blame anyone else for doubting them a little bit along the way. They didn't have Travis Head in that side, which is, you know, I think now we realize there was a couple of people like midway through the tournament saying to us on some of the lives, is Travis Head really that important? And me and Shine are like, well, based on his numbers in the last 2 years, we're going to say yes, because no one else is doing what he's doing, right? You know, the ability to score at basically a strike rate of 120 while averaging over 60 or whatever it was. It was remarkable how much he turned his career around. So that was a big difference, but also they just didn't have any form, right? We were talking about how they, even getting into the semifinals, they only had like five players in form. You know, to start the tournament, I don't know if they had five, right? So, you know, it was a big, big difference. You know, Adam Zampa looked like he was unbowlable in the early part of that tournament. Cummins and Stark weren't doing particularly well. Maxwell was probably their best bowler at the start of the tournament. So, yeah, it was a very different team from the start to the end. Weirdly enough, those two games really, really similar.
Yeah.
It's just that it happens in to the other team. So, you know, like in India, restrict Australia to a score that's quite easily chaseable. Then Australia take a bunch of early wickets and then India cruise to victory. And then the exact opposite happens in the final, which does tell you sometimes how much conditions and everything else can play a part as well in those sorts of games.
Absolutely. Quite the role reversal there that you've pointed out. But one more thing that Australia, and you pointed this out as well, did really well moving forward in the tournament is that at the start of the tournament, their fielding was, you know, lackluster. They weren't really putting the pressure on and they were allowing easy singles and whatnot. But towards the end, and particularly in the final, we saw that Australia were absolutely relentless in the field, right? They weren't giving India an inch. And they were basically saying that you're going to have to take a risk if you want to score some runs, because we'll be diving and scrambling and, you know, pushing our bodies around in order to basically keep that pressure on. And I think that was one of the big factors that ultimately led to Australia lifting the cup.
Yeah, you look at them in the semifinals well against South Africa, and, you know, quite early on, it was clear that they were fielding with a different level of intensity. I think early on in the series, it wasn't just that they were not fielding with that intensity, that they had all the fielders back on the edge of the circle, which is very 2015 style ODI cricket. And to be fair, Pat Cummins is a defensive captain. So, he probably is going to be like, well, I want everyone on the edge of the circle. But, you know, I wrote about this quite a lot, that India, Netherlands, Afghanistan were very good, and even New Zealand at times, at just having their fielders in closer, which means that you had to punch the ball through, right? Mm. But in order to have your fielders closer, they have to all be like completely madly diving for the ball, right? Because otherwise, it doesn't work. And we saw that at times with Afghanistan, where some of their fielding couldn't maintain the pressure that they wanted to just because of that. And so, you know, it's a bit like, you know, and Australia is a little bit like a team that has won titles before, that knows what, you know, when it comes to it, they will try a little bit harder at the more important times. And there was, I think there was an element of Australia in that. Perhaps in the middle of the tournament, you don't want to be diving for every single ball, right? It's hot. You've got a long tournament in front of you and everything else. But once you get to the semifinals and the finals, you know, you have that sort of what Americans would call playoff intensity, where everything ratchets up. There's no doubt that Australia was much smarter with their field placings in the back half of the tournament, but was also completely backed up by an intensity and, you know, a combination of skill and energy that stopped so many of those balls.
Yeah, that was most evident when you looked at David Warner, right? I mean, he looked like a spring chicken, a 17-year-old throwing himself around, and someone said that he might be available just as a subfielder for the next World Cup. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting how you brought in Pat Cummins into that as well, how we've regularly spoken about him being a pragmatic captain, even in the Ashes. This was a, you know, predominant sort of discourse topic. So in this game in particular, Pat Cummins with the ball, he had his best game. You know, shit World Cup, let's be honest. He wasn't really turning up with the ball at all. And come final, he takes 2 for 34, does not concede a single boundary, and accounts for the big wickets of Shreyas Iyer, who was in red hot form, and Virat Kohli, the biggest wicket on the day, pretty much. And it's interesting how, you know, Ravi Ashwin pointed this out, that Pat Cummins was basically bowling to an off-spinner's field, so packed leg side field, and he had no mid-off. And it's remarkable how he pulled this off. Also because he was bowling those 80 mile per hour off-spinners, right? Those cutters. And none of his deliveries were coming to or proving to be too fruitful throughout the World Cup. But the slow ones, you know, he really maximized on those. And you'd have to say that's a tactical masterclass by Cummins.
Yeah, I mean, he tried it on other pitches. It's funny, very early on in his spell, I was on Cricket 8 at the time, and I said he's bowling like he did in Ranchi and when he made his comeback to Test cricket, where he bowled. And I specifically mentioned the ball where he bounced KL Rahul out with a cutter. And it was a cutter that was still at over 80 miles an hour because of Cummins' pace, right? But the reason it really got KL Rahul is because it also deviated off the pitch, shot followed him, right? It was a brute of a ball. I mean, if you can ever go back and find it, it's an incredible ball. And we've seen him try that before. The problem is that those kinds of wickets in India haven't really been around all that much, right? So, you know, if you go back to Lance Klusener taking a 7-wicket haul with cutters, and, you know, we've seen some great spells of bowlers coming in and bowling cutters in India in the past. Those wickets haven't existed as much. And Pat Cummins clearly came in with that in mind of, that's what I will do. And then he didn't come across a single wicket that really assisted any of those until he gets to the final. And then suddenly it's like, oh, okay, I can do this again. But as Ash said, like the ability to set a field that essentially for an off spinner and then not have an mid off and everything else. And if you look at the ball to Kohli, it's essentially no different than someone trying to cut an off spinner because all the fielders are on the leg side. So they're trying to get an easy, you know, couple on the offside. And the ball just cramps him up and he ends up playing it back on. It really is more of an off-spinner's wicket than it is a seam bowler's wicket. And I don't know how much credit to give Pat Cummins for all that, because he definitely gets it for the skill and the execution and the field settings. But he had been trying this whole tournament and it hadn't actually worked. And finally he got a surface where he could do it. And that was the wicket, right? Like, that's the wicket that probably stops him from scoring over 250, 260. And really changes the entire game from there.
Yeah, and you trust Ravi Ashwin to pick up on these things, because he mentioned how India do this in Test cricket, you know, bowl to that predominant leg side field and basically just try to cramp the batter whenever you present some room on the offside. But it's interesting how he said that, oh, well, remarkable, really, that Pat Cummins didn't really bowl any wides down the leg side, because that's what Ashwin said, that is not a thing in Test cricket, but it's quite impressive that that didn't happen in an ODI game either.
Also, and with the Indians bowlers do it, it's quite often because they come from very wide on the crease. A lot of their bowlers are natural, have that angle, especially Bumrah and Mohammad Siraj. The other difference, what Cummins is doing is he's actually bowling it from a little bit closer on the crease, but then bowling the cutters. So it's slightly different even again to what India was doing, where theirs is a little bit more natural. So, yeah, it's – look, Cummins spent all World Cup trying to come up with a way to actually make his bowling work. And the one game when they needed it, he did.
Yeah, and I mean, he was taking pictures of the deck a day earlier, so clearly he knew what was up. Of course, he called the toss right as well. And it's really funny, you know, how India, with all this pitch discourse, you had the switch pitch and everything, and a lot of it is blown out of proportion. We know that as well. But it's funny how in the final, they presented Pat Cummins with a pitch which was tailor-made for him to do exactly that. I think the irony lost there.
No, definitely. And the whole thing about the pitch was, it was funny. I was talking to Nagraj from Cricket Info yesterday, and I said to him, I was talking to him, and I said, surely if India wanted to doctor the pitch, they would have just made them spin sideways, right? Like, and he's like, yeah, of course. Like, if India was actually doctoring the pitches, that is not the pitch that they would end up with. And there are a lot of issues with ICC pitch curation when it comes to major tournaments that I've been flagging up for since 2017. And it definitely is an issue. And I'm not saying there wasn't interference, because I think there was interference. I do think people within Indian cricket were trying to get certain pitches. In fact, you know, without wanting to break any news, I think there might be some people within the Indian camp who are a little bit upset with that wicket. And maybe they weren't even asking for that particular kind of wicket, right? That people thought they might want something like that. So, yeah, no, it's funny. And then the fact that it ends up helping Australia. And remember, the other important thing is here is that Australia read it better than India did. Because India were going to bat first anyway.
Yeah.
Right? So if the... You know, of all the outcomes, this is the least likely that Australia win the toss and make a better decision than India were going to make. That's no one would have had that down on their bingo card. And I suppose that's why it's one of the things I want to look at with this piece, right? And I know I'm probably jumping the gun and you're like having to cross out questions. But essentially, the main thing is, oh, India choked. But there's a lot of things that happen in this particular game that no one could have really foreseen, like a confluence of so many different things happened. Like, who would have thought that Australia would have had the balls to bowl first in this World Cup final? Yeah. Like, I was with Nikesh Raghani when that happened. We both looked at each other and went, what? Right? And, you know, Ashwin talked about going and finding George Bailey and asking him the same question, right? Like, everyone was thinking the exact same thing. There were so many little things like, okay, we're going to use this pitch. Not knowing that it's going to make Pat Cummins unplayable, right? Yeah, yeah. Like all these little things that happened were so bizarre.
I mean, I remember when we recorded, I think it was a red inker prior to the final, both you and I were convinced that Australia need to bat first. Like you said, everyone pretty much was shocked with that decision. Estelle wasn't. Estelle called it. She's the one person I know who called it, right? But I just, like, before we go on to the other stuff and the whole India choking debate, I want to talk about this a little, because sure, the toss had a role to play, right? And the conditions are undoubtedly one of the reasons why Australia won. And Sanjay Manjrekar is not wrong, even if it's kind of a sore loserish look when you say that on TV. But it is correct. You know, the conditions did play a big part. But to your point, Pat Cummins read them to a T. And Rohit Sharma said that he would have batted first. Now, he could have also said that just to, you know, give his players confidence that, oh, we don't want to show any sign of weakness. We want to be this masculine team or whatever, that we were going to bat first anyway. But it's very likely that he was just going to bat first regardless. You know, the whole runs on the board psyche. So with respect to reading the conditions and calling the toss, how superior was Pat Cummins to Rohit Sharma?
I mean, quite clearly, I think India were going to bat first. I don't think it was a macho thing. So I do think he read that better. Also think that when you're the weaker side, it's actually more important. India could have won that winning the toss, losing the toss, batting first, batting second, making a mistake on the toss, right? Australia kind of had to get everything right in order to win. So I do think that is a full part of it. Just to go back to Sanjay Manjrekar point, I think you're right. But I would say, to be fair to Sanjay Manjrekar, compared to most commentators and people who work in the media, he's probably more of an analyst. And what he said is very true.
Yeah.
The problem with that is that it is in the world, in a world of Shoaib Akhtar and, you know, and hot takes and, you know, Michael Vaughan and these sorts of people, when Sanjay Mandrake says something that is essentially more or less correct, in some ways, I think it was a lot deeper than that, which is why I went further with it.
Yeah.
But when he says something like that, people, that's not what people want to hear. What do people want to hear? India choked. Right. And what Sanjay Mandrake is saying is, well, if you look at the conditions, Australia got the better of the conditions. And I don't think there's any denying that at all. But within that, you also have to give Australia the credit for taking what was the tougher decision.
So Sanjay's exact words were that it was conditions that more or less beat India more than Australia, something along those lines, which is, I'm paraphrasing. But basically, I think what he was saying is correct. The way he phrased it kind of made it look a bit excusey and not give Australia enough credit for that win. I think that's where the issue is.
And I would take a step further anyway of essentially World Cups are, everyone who's ever listened to these podcasts will know I've said this a million times, but problem solving events, right? So you know whether you have a quarterfinals, semifinals and finals, or you just had the semifinals and finals, that you have to win three successive games or two successive games to be able to win this tournament. You know that you're probably going to lose the toss. I mean, look at India versus New Zealand a couple of years ago, right? Incredible situation where they, no one going into that game thought that India was going to have to bat on the morning of day two, right? Like just things that no one really assumed would happen, happened, right? And World Cups have those sorts of things. Go through the history of World Cups, you know, all these bizarre moments that have happened over and over again. What Sanjay is saying is right, but that doesn't matter because that's how you win World Cups, right? Especially when you are the better team, right?
Yeah.
If you go back and you have a look at, you know, situations where, like, you know, Australia in 1999 is a perfect example of didn't really play their best cricket in either of those two games against South Africa, but they found a way to get past them, right? You know, we see that in World Cups again and again, teams working out how to be, you know, how to get past certain situations, how to handle, you know, the opposition and work their way through, even when the toss goes against them, even when they make a mistake at the toss, even when the conditions are not in their favor. That is how you have to win a World Cup because that's what knockout games are. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with what Sanjay said. As you said, he might have phrased it slightly incorrectly, but there's nothing wrong with what he said. But that's also missing the point. Right? Of Australia made the most out of that toss, but B, there was at one stage, the conditions actually did swing back in favor of India, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
And Australia still remained on top in that particular game. So you have to credit the Australians for that. And also I have to say that India played a large part in their own problems here, even if the pitch was tricky, and it was.
And we'll get into right into that, actually, because like you mentioned, you know, the popular narrative is that India choked and all of this. But, you know, the truth is that this is probably one of the best ODI units ever assembled, which did not go on to lift the cup. And that's why we're having this podcast, essentially, right?
Yep.
Now, you have repeatedly spoken of, and anyone who listens regularly to your work will know of the Evan Gulbis effect, right? And by having Mohammad Shami batting at 8, India did kind of succumb to the Evan Gulbis effect. So just in case some of our listeners or viewers are not aware of what this phenomena is, please enlighten them, Jared.
I'll try and do it as quickly as possible. I already realized in the draft for this piece, I probably need to slim it down a little bit. Essentially, Evan Gulbis was one of those people who probably never plays much cricket professionally if it wasn't for the Big Bash. But he had a particular skill set where he could bowl. I don't even know what sort of a cricketer. He's kind of like your bargain basement version of Dan Christian, right? Where he does everything that Dan Christian does, but not quite on the level of Dan Christian. Like he bowls a bit faster than most, you know, fifth and sixth bowlers do, but he's not really a frontline bowler. He can bat, but he's probably at best, you know, a good number eight or a handy number seven. Can pinch hit occasionally, but not a star at that. But a very good fielder as well.
Would you say he qualifies as a bits and pieces cricketer, or do we have to call Sanjay again for that one?
No, he's definitely a bits and pieces cricketer. I don't think Evan Gulbis would argue with that, right? Like, there's no, if Evan Goldbus just was a bowler or just was a batter, he would got nowhere near cricket. Right? It's the combination of all those things and the fielding. So the Melbourne Stars, when I first started talking to them about him years ago, they basically mentioned the fact that they called him a three-tool player, which is a baseball term, right? Because they were looking at him as he's handy in the field, he's handy with the bat, he's handy with the ball, right? They knew he wasn't very good with any of those. Anyways, he goes on to play, a career where, I'm like one of seven people who remember Evan Goldbus, right? He plays his last game, I think it's the 2018-2019 Big Bash semi-final, plays a game where he's listed at batting at number eight. Melbourne Stars use six bowlers. He doesn't bowl and he doesn't bat, right? Mm. Proper Shardul Thakur type game, right? And that's the semi-final and the Stars win easy. And then for the final, they're like, well, we didn't even use Evan last game, right? So we don't need to pick him for the final. We'll bring in Jackson Bird. Jackson Bird comes in for the final, takes two early wickets, bowls beautifully. They move Adam Zampa up to number eight. He ends up making runs. So on paper, right, they completely cover Evan Goldbus.
Yeah.
Right? But Melbourne Stars lose that game. And the reason they lose that game is I think Dan Christian and Tom Cooper pushed the score up to about 137, right? Bit of a tricky wicket, but 137, well under par. The Stars openers are Ben Dunk and Marcus Stoinis, right? So one famous around the world and the other one famous in Pakistan. and they put on a huge opening partnership. But I think Ben Dunk's strike rate is 120 and Stoinis goes at a runner ball, right? And there is absolutely no doubt that they were looking at that scoreboard and looking at who was batting at number eight. And they played the majority of their games that year. They had people like Liam Plunkett batting at number eight. They even had a guy called Nick Larkins, who's a really good first-class batter, as a specialist batting at number eight in some games. Mm. And they're looking up going, the only way we can lose this is if we're bowled out, right? So we'll just go as deep as we can. And then eventually we've got Glenn Maxwell, Peter Hanscom, and Dwayne Bravo later on. They can catch up for us. But they get so stuck. And of course what happens is they lose a bunch of quick wickets. Maxwell goes out. And in the end, Adam Zampa is the one at number eight who has to hit them towards victory and they lose the game. And I predicted this. I was the analyst this team, right? I predicted this happening the minute I saw Goldbus wasn't in that side, right? Just because it didn't matter for me. So they had Goldbus, they had Stoinis, and they had Maxwell as the kind of bits and pieces bowlers, right? And they just looked at it and went, well, Maxwell and Stoinis can do Goldbus's role, so we don't need him. That was fine with the bowling, and they didn't need him with the bowling. But with the batting, it just meant that the openers went that little bit too slow, got themselves into a rut. And to be fair to the Renegades, they bowled beautifully. Harry Gurney and I think it was Kane Richardson bowled absolutely perfectly. But the truth is that there's no way Marcus Stoinis would ever score a runner ball in a game like that if he felt a little bit more comfortable about what was to come afterwards, right? He would have pushed his foot down a little bit more. So the Evan Goldbus effect is, and you got to remember, you're getting a lot of extra details here, but when T20 cricket started getting analyzed and, started getting money balled and all this sort of stuff, one thing that a lot of analysts, and I think even I might have said this early on, was number seven faces like eight balls on average. So why are you spending all this money on a number seven who can bat? And why are you worrying about who can bat at number eight, right? And it wasn't until I started to work with teams directly and I started to listen to them talk that I actually realized really why it was important. And it was also my time with RCB of, having discussions about Virat's batting. And you realize how Virat bats with different partners and when he looks at the order, right? And, we'll come on to KRL said the exact same things publicly. You realize that these guys are looking at the order. They are looking down and they are making decisions early on based on what might happen later on. Mm. And so for me, the easiest way to explain it is the Evan Goldbus effect. I mean, no one, he's not a cricketer who's going to go down in history as a legend. Mm. So it's nice to name something after him, but it's a real thing and it doesn't affect everyone because as we saw in this game, Rohit Sharma did not care that Mohammad Shami was batting at number eight. It did not enter his brain. And there are plenty of players who do think that way. And, Glenn Maxwell Glenn Maxwell doesn't worry about what happens after Glenn Maxwell, right?
Yeah.
He's Glenn Maxwell and he's going to bat like Glenn Maxwell. But that is not the case with all batters. And there are some batters who will look up at the batting order And, you know, as a club cricketer, I've been in games where once I kind of got it, I thought started thinking back to my career. And I remember a game where I was playing where we had, and this has happened multiple times, but I remember a game where we had no batting after number five. I think I came in at first drop and I hit about 3 fours early on and I was feeling it. And then I was like, I can't keep chasing this because if I go out and we lose one more wicket, we have no batting.
Yeah.
So I had to clamp up and play a different style of game. This is a very real thing. And it's one of those things that is very hard to quantify. But I definitely think it played a part in India losing this game.
Yeah. And like you pointed out, you know, it would impact different batters differently. And basically, you know, long story short, the Evan Gulbis effect is the psychological or potential psychological impact a batter could face by not having security at number 8. Right.
Yeah. And it could be number 7 as well. Yeah. I should say that we've seen that all together. In fact, I remember Australia A playing years ago when they had a weird experimental team and they said that like the top 5 got together and said, we have to make all the runs because we don't trust the number 6. Right. So this is a thing that is going on. You know, it's not just about the number 8 position. It can be number 7. We saw it with South Africa. I think part of the success of the South African team came from the fact that they hadn't, before Marco Jansen, they had no one at number 7 they trusted, right? And so they got together as a top 6 and went, we have to make all the runs.
Anyway, another theory with respect to India losing ICC knockout games over the last decade is that they become defensive with both bat and ball come knockout games. Now, you know, according to Bharat Sundaresan, who wrote a piece on this, the one guy Australia really wanted to get out quickly was Shreyas Iyer. He was the one who dominated the team talks and they were really wanting to get him, you know, back in the hut quickly because, look, against spin, he was literally, you know, those straight sixes were out of hell. He was massacring spin and his rate of scoring was really otherworldly towards the end of this, back end of this tournament. Also, Rohit was in rampage mode and Shubman Gill, by design, goes at overrun a ball, even though it doesn't really look like it, but he just has that natural pace. So Australia basically wanted both KL and Kohli out there early. And like you mentioned, KL in the past in IPL seasons has mentioned how, you know, if he just bats deep, he can go and explode later. And how, you know, not having enough security in the batting order is one of the reasons why that happens. And also Virat Kohli versus South Africa. He, coughs and Gulbis, literally admitted to it, right? That he went slower in that innings because he did not have enough faith in the lower order. So this really is where Australia won the tactical battle, you would have to say, with respect to limiting India's first innings total, which was essential with respect to them winning that final.
Yeah. What was interesting to me was that Australia was that on top of it. I had written a piece where I think I took the conversations that you, me and Estelle had and I sort of put it together of a few different ways that Australia could win the game. And I, if you have a look, I think it was option 4 that I came up with is this almost essentially what Australia used to win the game. And I thought that was one of the least likely ones. But Australia didn't feel that way. And going back and listening to, you know, what Bharat had to say and everything else, you realize that. But then once I actually put it all together, I was like, actually, it makes sense. Virat Kohli had said early in the tournament, and we had already proven that he had scored slower in this tournament when Shardul Thakur was not playing compared to when Shardul Thakur was playing, right? And on top of that, so the KL Rahul thing you said as well, you go back, certainly when he was at Kings 11, whichever other side he was at that he was playing for as well, he was really clear going, you're all saying I'm batting too slow. Our batting isn't very deep and we don't trust it. Literally, as you said, he was saying the Evan Gulbis out loud, right?
Yeah.
And so Australia clearly thought that they could put pressure on those two guys. Now, if you look at this tournament, you would have to say that that's a risky thing to do because both of those players could have easily made hundreds and kicked on at the end and Australia would have looked like idiots. Remember, it was literally those two players who beat Australia in that first game with their innings. So the fact that Shreyas Iyer is a difference maker because I don't think you can keep him down by just bowling spin, right? So most players in the world, if you bowl, you know, spin, you can at least keep them to less than a run a ball or, you know, a strike rate of 85, 90. Shreyas Iyer is not like that, right? And, you know, is probably certainly the best scorer of spin in the world, but maybe one of the best players of spin in the world as well. So combined, you can't really get him out and he's going to score quickly. So it was interesting that they were so clear on that plan that they had to get Shreyas Iyer out. One thing I would say is, like, having worked for a lot of teams, in fact, going back to that game, if you go back and have a look at the Melbourne Stars, Melbourne Renegades final that they lost that we were talking about before, almost I had a plan of how we would win that game. And for 75% of the game, it went exactly to plan. And then we still lost that game. So, and many times you come up with a plan and nothing happens, anything like your plan, and you still win easily, right? So it probably looks a little bit more special that it all went the way that they wanted. But the truth is that they did believe that Virat and Kale would go slow. And then Virat and Kale completely reverted to type there. And I think Kale Rowell is one of the most interesting players in the world. He's maligned often for the wrong things, I think. Again, he made runs in a big pressure game, by the way. And that was one thing he wasn't supposed to be able to do. But the thing he should be maligned for more is that he has the ability to score at 1.5 runs per ball. And too often, he decides to score at half of that, right? And I think Virat is very similar. I don't think he slows down quite as much as KL, although he has at times. But again, these guys could score so much quicker than they do. And the real problem with that partnership from a scoring perspective wasn't that they scored slow. It's that they didn't put any pressure back on Australia at any point, right? They didn't look for twos, and they couldn't look for twos because they weren't looking for boundaries, right? And this is why, you know, when people say to me, oh, can't you just score a lot of twos? It's very hard to score twos when the other team doesn't think you're going to score a boundary, because they will creep in off the boundary. Mm. They will cut off all the angles. Suddenly you're in a bad place. But it really was a combination there of Coley had no problem scoring singles. KL did get stuck scoring singles a few times. But neither of them looked like scoring boundaries, and neither of them looked like scoring twos. And they put no pressure on Cummins' fields or his mini bowling changes. Mm. And that's the one other thing I would say is, you know, his random roulette bowling changes, which again goes back to the Melbourne Stars, was Maxwell was one of the first players I saw to do that for that season that we lost that final. Why I thought that was a genius idea against these two is that they want to bat on autopilot, right? And it's very hard to bat on autopilot when the bowlers are changing every over. But once you realize that's what the opposition are doing, again, you have to actually make a choice. Mm-hmm. And it felt like Virat and Kale decided not to make any choices and just to bat as long as they could. And of course, that all gets unstuck when they don't get bat as long as they could.
As a cricket fan, you know the most important time of the calendar is here, when the Southern Hemisphere aligns with so much cricket. So if you're busy watching all those matches, let me suggest Factor, a ready-to-eat meal delivery service that can help you with your breakfast, which is the only important meal, and also lunch and dinner if you need it. With chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. 35-plus weekly flavor-packed, fresh, never frozen meals that support a healthy lifestyle and meet your meal preferences, all delivered right to your door, ready to eat in 2 minutes. Eat breakfast items like their delicious apple cinnamon pancakes, bacon and cheddar egg bites, and potato bacon and egg breakfast skillets. These people will send bacon and eggs to your home while you watch a test match. This is the dream, people. So if you are looking for meals at home these holidays while you prepare for the most important day of the year, Boxing Day, head to factormeals.com/Inca50 and use the code Inca50 to get 50% off. That's code Inca50 at factormeals.com/Inca50 to get 50% off. That's half price Boxing Day meals. Stuff them in your mouth without missing a ball.
Yeah. Which is what's so fascinating to me, right? Like, I'm imagining what that team talk was like in the war room when they were planning for this game, right? We get Shreyas, and then we have India right where we want them, on the back foot. And it's evident, you know, Kohli got off to a decently quick start, especially if you compare his starts to other games in this tournament. He got 3 quick boundaries, and then, like you said, he just went into his risk-averse shell where he wasn't bothered and just took his singles. And KL too, like, there are two sides to the KL Rahul innings, right? One is that he did soak in the pressure and he stuck it out there and he scored 66 runs. And had he not scored those runs, maybe India would have folded even quicker. But the other side is that, of course, 66 runs off 107 deliveries is, without a doubt, painstakingly slow. And it is evidence, both of these things, of the Evan Gulbis effect in full flow. Like, this is not a theory at this point. This is what happened. And it might not be the biggest or only reason why India lost this game, but it was really a key, you could say, facet of this battle that took place. And I get the school of thought that, hey, let's stick it out over here and let's not take risks right now so that we can go for it later. But that did not pay off for India at all. And there was
I think to be fair to them, they would have expected one of those guys to make 100.
Yeah.
And why would they not expect one of those guys to make 100 when they both have top 10 batting averages of all time in ODI cricket, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it makes sense. And I did the research that India make us a plus 75 score, have a player score over 75 virtually every game in the last 4 years, right? Mm-hmm. It's very rare for them to have a game when no one scores over 75 unless they're like chasing 111 or something, right?
I actually have those stats in front of me. So last four years prior to the World Cup, 74 ODIs India have played. On 73 occasions, at least one batter has scored 75. And in the history of ODI cricket, out of all the batters who have scored a minimum of 2,000 runs, 10 average over 50, two of them are KL Rahul and Virat Kohli. So you'd really think that one of these guys will explode at one point and India will somehow get 300. And if they had 300 on the board, it's a totally different ball game, right? Yeah. Which makes this final all the more ridiculous. Like, it's an anomaly of outrageous proportions because the highest score was KL Rahul's 107 ball 66.
Yeah. And I think that it's easy to look back and go, well, KL and Virat didn't kick on, especially Virat. Okay, he was out quite early when you think about it. Didn't kick on. And so the Evan Goldbus effect was the major factor. And I'm not saying it didn't play a part here. And how slow they played, and also the pitch, and we'll get to the pitch a little bit more in the next bit. But the other thing that is really, really worth remembering here is that if those two had kicked on and they both made hundreds, India probably make minimum, 260, 270? Mm. That's a lot more pressure on Australia. Chances are they make even more than that and they get up towards 280, 290 even at that point.
Yeah.
And because of that, they probably win the game. Mm. And would anyone be going on about how slow they scored, right? And so a lot of these things, and this is why, do you remember we did a podcast and people got really upset with the ifs and buts, right?
Yeah.
The ifs and buts are why I do what I do. Because it's very good team win, bad team lose. That's not actually how sport works.
Yeah.
Quite often you will have a team who has played much better than the opposition, but they're not very good. And so they actually still manage to find a way to lose the game, or the opposite happens, or both teams play absolutely brilliant, but one wins and the other one loses, right? Mm. Or there's a fluke confluence of events that happen, or whatever that may be. And what I really wanted to do this particular piece is because I didn't want it just to be India choke and Australia superpower. Mm-hmm. I wanted to show all the different things that happened. And the truth is that if Virat Kohli gets the inside edge and instead of going back onto his stumps, it hits his thigh pad, right? There's a very good chance that India make a lot more runs, feel a lot more comfortable and go into that the second part of the game in a completely different headspace, right? And they could have very much won the game. Doesn't mean that the conditions still wouldn't have been against them, right? Mm. Or anything else. Doesn't mean that they wouldn't have batted too slow. Doesn't mean that they shouldn't have put more pressure on Australia in those middle overs. But that is just how cricket is. And people don't want to accept that these things happen because they just want it as black and white. And of course, especially in a podcast like this, we could not be any more gray.
Yeah, absolutely. The gray area is where it's at. And it's interesting, you also pointed out the parallel between the scoring rates or combined scoring rates of the KL and Kohli partnership and the Head and Marnus partnership. And they're not too dissimilar. The only difference is that Head went on a run and it just lasted longer. And Australia weren't under that pressure of scoring quickly at all. Whereas India always had that cloud hanging over their head that, oh, we do have to go after it at some point. And I think it's really interesting because, sure, they consolidated and they wanted to rebuild and everything. But, you know, in the 37th over of Glenn Maxwell, Australia's fifth bowler, KL Rahul, who was well set by this time, got one run of five deliveries. So clearly, he was done mentally and clearly it had taken a toll on him because that plan was backfiring and the pressure was mounting. And like you mentioned, Cummins using seven bowlers in that 10-over period, 16th to 25th over, which again is quite unprecedented. How much of it was conditions and how much of it was you know, the pressure.
Yeah, look, I think you're batting first at a World Cup. You've lost a couple of wickets. You're on a tricky pitch, right? Hmm. It was not an easy pitch to score on. And I think that has to be factored in. So Australia had a much easier pitch to score on than India had. Australia had other issues with their pitch because they were, you know, under lights with the ball nipping around and everything. Yeah. So they had other things that they had to overcome. But they had the ball just came onto the bat far better when Australia were batting than it did for India. You can't deny that. It was just obvious, right?
Absolutely.
And then, as you said, they knew the chase, right? Mm. So everything was in their advantage. But yeah, look, I do think the pressure got to them a little bit. Mm. But on top of that, the situation got to them. As in, especially with KL, when he slows down, that is because I can't remember if they were 4 wickets down. I think they were 5 wickets down in that 37th over, right? Mm. He's facing Glenn Maxwell, who, let's be honest, KL should just be able to heave over the leg side at any stage, right? He's got Sky at the other end. He's got 13 overs to go. And so he is batting completely to that situation. The problem being that, again, there was no pressure put back on Australia. So Australia got away with a near maiden without really having to do anything. All they had to do was roll out their fifth best bowler, get him to bowl some darts at leg stump, and they got away with the maiden. And that is which it was too easy for Australia on too many occasions. Because I actually, this is going to sound weird. I think that that Cummins went in with the plan of changing all those bowlers. And actually, on that pitch, might have been better off bowling Mitchell Marsh more up front when the conditions were in his favor. And, you know, at times he wasn't, like he was yanking people out of the attack when they were bowling well. And I was like, I get it. I see what you're doing here. And ultimately he won the game, so that's fine. But I was sitting there going, Mitch Marsh is bowling so well, you can just steal a bunch of Mitch Marsh overs here. But none of that mattered because India never puts any pressure back on. And by the time you get to the 37th over, that isn't a case of the Gulbis effect at that point, right? Mm. It's the case of even if they had a strong number eight at that point, they're 5 wickets down in the 37th over and they've got a defensive bowler up against them.
Yeah.
And KL was in such a defensive mind frame by that point that he wasn't even finding a way to put any single pressure back on Australia.
Here's an interesting question for you. It's a bit technical. I don't know the answer to it, but basically what I've noticed based on what I've seen from KL Rahul and after observing him for all these years is that when he's in that full flowing freedom sort of mode, when he's playing his shots with liberty, the wrists come into play. Is very strong wrists, and those wrists alone can hit some sixes. Is that the mind frame thing that versus Maxwell, who you could very easily use the wrists against to kind of get underneath him, flatter trajectory, you know, use that to hit it out of the park? He didn't even think of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a Ian Chappell has, you know, gone on about this for years, but what can happen with a batter is that once you get into a situation where you are thinking of survival, it's actually very hard to then also accumulate and very hard to put any pressure back or to take any chances. Mm-hmm. And you know, especially KRL. So KRL is one of those batters that has 5 gears, mm-hmm. right? If you compare that to, you know, there are many other players in the world that don't have all 5 gears. Doesn't mean they're not very good players. They just don't have that full tool kit available to them. The problem with having the 5 gears is that in that kind of situation, once you gear down so low, it's very hard for you to even get to the sort of third gear, which is what he needed to be in that Maxwell over, right?
Yeah.
Just make sure that you get a single off the first 2 balls. If you get back on strike, make sure you get one more single off the next 2 balls. You're getting yourself 3 to 4 runs off that over rather than the 1 run. That over didn't need to go for 15 or anything like that. But also, if you've got a defensive bowler and you've also got a defensive mindset, right? Maxwell knows exactly where to bowl that over, right? He knows KL Rahul. He's bowled against him many times before. He's seen him play, but he knows exactly where to bowl that over. And so the only way to really break free of that is to actually from either just go for the singles, as I said, and completely plant on the singles. But actually the better way of doing that is to be like, well, he's going to bowl these balls roughly here. What's my best chance of hitting a boundary or looking for a 2? But KL didn't have any of that in his mindset. And if you go back to Virat, Virat was exactly the same. He was better at scoring the singles, but it was exactly the same thing of neither of them were looking to how to score their next boundary. And so you're right. There are skills that he could have used at that time to be able to do that, but they were parked somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
He was literally looking at the basic survival thing. And once you do that, you're putting yourself in a situation where you can't put any pressure back on the opposition. And realistically, as good a bowler as Maxwell can be, you should always be looking to try and hit him for a boundary, because what you want with Maxwell is you want him to do something stupid. Mm-hmm. You want him to go chasing. You want him to be out of his thing. If you just tell Maxwell that he can bowl six balls in the most defensive place possible, he will do that. He's a good enough bowler to be able to do that. His problem is when you actually hit one of those balls for four or you do something different, he doesn't handle that as well, because he's not a fully, you know, he's not a frontline bowler. He still doesn't have those skills available to him.
Regardless of what George Bailey thinks of him, of course. But another tactical blunder by...
George Bailey was right. He had a bloody good tournament, to be fair.
Yeah, I mean, George Bailey won the World Cup for Australia, you know, as chief selector. So he's going to remember this one. But another tactical blunder by India was Ravindra Jadeja's promotion over Sky in the batting order. Now, India clearly did not trust or have faith in Sky, you know, batting in the middle overs under pressure. And they sent Jadeja ahead of him. Now, but that's a bit weird, because Jadeja couldn't manage to break the shackles either. And he doesn't particularly enjoy attacking spin much, particularly on that sort of wicket, right? That only makes that job harder. So, you know, why not just send Sky ahead of Jadeja to potentially exert some of that pressure back on Australia? Do you think that was one of the other flaws that India made in this game?
So you said earlier that one of the big problems with India... So India is now seen as chokers, right?
Hmm.
But I've looked at all these tournaments and the same thing keeps happening. And it isn't choking. It's defensive mindsets.
Yeah.
Right? And this game had exactly the same issues. Rohit did everything he could to change this team's mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came down to it, they went defensive. And the Jadeja promotion is a big part of that. So I think, and I'm going to throw this out and see what you, mm-hmm. if you agree. I think if Maxwell was batting at six, right, and Australia had a Jadeja at seven, Maxwell definitely would have come in next.
Yeah.
Because Australia would have been like, A, he can completely change this moment, but B, it means that there is pressure being put back on, which there hasn't. We haven't put any scoreboard pressure on this team in ages. Sky goes out there, he sweeps Maxwell first ball for four. Suddenly, the whole game changes, and Australia has to think about everything completely different. Even if he only makes 40 off 35 balls, then Jadeja comes in. We'll be in such a better position than we would be. Whereas they went with Jadeja. And Jadeja is... So, to go back to the KL Rahul five gears, Jadeja doesn't have five gears, right? Mm-hmm. Jadeja is a proper Daniel Vittori-style all-rounder. He probably has three gears. And he's excellent in those three gears, but it is a little bit first gear, mm-hmm. a little bit of third gear, and a little bit of fifth gear, right? Uh-huh. Doesn't really have the full... It can't ramp up and ramp down. In that situation... They really needed someone who could put a little bit of pressure back on. And as you said, he doesn't like spin. He doesn't feel that comfortable batting in those middle overs, and he never has, right? He's become such a great player at the death in T20 cricket and in one-day cricket, but he's never really been great in that earlier period. So they're throwing him in, and of course, he reverts to first gear mode.
Mm-hmm.
Now it means that KL, who was already slow, has an even slower batter with him.
Yeah.
Right? And so they go from Virat at least scoring singles to no singles at all. And the innings completely stopped. Now, my idea of having Sky up there, Sky could have gone in, they could, you know, Dravid or Rohit could have said to him, go out there and see what you can do. And he could have failed third ball, right?
Yeah.
But that would have been a proactive move. What they made was a defensive move. And I think they do that too much in knockout games. And it completely, well, what did he make? 9 of 26?
Something like that. 26? Maybe 9 of 22, I think.
Yeah, it was such a, you know, a slow and torturous, you know, innings. In fact, I've got it right in front of me. I don't know why I'm Googling here. Oh, no, I've lost it again. It was such an incredibly slow innings. And it was the worst sort of worst thing that you could have happen in that situation, right?
Because it was like a sponge which sucks up all of the momentum and takes it away.
And they didn't have any momentum, right? So 9 of 22, you're right.
Whatever they had.
Yeah. And so you're sending, and I understand it. As I said, I understand what they're trying to, they're basically saying, well, Sky's not a proper one-day player. On top of that, you know, you have a situation where we really want Sky more for the end. Although I would have argued that Jadeja is just as good at the end. Maybe not just as good, but it was also really good at the end. But they didn't put any pressure back on Australia again. And I'm pretty sure that was the only time in this whole tournament they changed their batting lineup. And they did it in a defensive way. And it got them... It was... I think Sky going out and failing wouldn't have been as bad as Jadeja going out and making 9 off 22 and completely stopping the momentum. And I know that sounds crazy, but it would have shown that they were still trying to fight Australia. And by bringing Jadeja out, like, Australia must have been over the moon when they saw Jadeja come out, because they knew a bunch of dot balls were going to happen. They knew they could bowl their spinners for a lot longer. Sky would have made their spinners' life a little bit trickier at that point. And so, again, I think that was a mistake. And I think that does go back to this overall thing of when the pressure is on in a knockout game, India will revert to defensive tactics. And I just think in knockout games, you've got to kind of choke the other team out. And I don't think India managed to do that enough.
And it's interesting because they hadn't really seen those pressure situations all tournament because they were coasting, right? They were just steamrolling other teams and they hadn't really seen that kind of adversity. And the first instance where they did go a bit on the defensive. And my issue with this is that, you know, we talk about Sky being there in the team in that Joss Butler type of role. Now, Joss Butler would get a promotion in England's batting order in ODI cricket at times, but never a demotion. It's never going to happen, right? You'll never see it. And we did see that with Sky. And what you did essentially is also remove Jadeja from his role. And he wasn't particularly doing great with the bat in the build-up to this World Cup. But in the World Cup, he had some good knocks, some quick fire 30s and 40s.
Playing in that death batting role, right?
Exactly. So why would you mess with that? Maybe even if Sky fails, Jadeja comes in good because he's in that same kind of mind frame. And if you go back to the semi-final versus New Zealand that India lost in 2019, Jadeja played quite well, right? So just, you know, messing around with those roles. And even, you didn't mention this, but I think that opening the bowling with Shami too, that didn't make much sense to me because Siraj was better utility with the new ball, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, you're right. That should be in, because it was something I talked about a lot during the World Cup previously. I think they ruined Siraj again. Again, another defensive move that looks like an attacking move, right? But actually what they're saying is we don't quite trust Siraj with the new ball under pressure. Yeah. And if you look at Australia, right, where they kind of did the opposite. They could have easily... When the new ball was moving around, they could have moved Steve Smith up the order and moved Mitch Marsh down. You know, they could have got, you know, no one expected Mitch Marsh to make a lot of runs in that kind of situation. They made attacking moves with their bowlers all the way through. As I said, maybe I would almost say they went too far. They completely trusted Mitchell Starc, right? Even though he had a really poor tournament. They trusted Pat Cummins. Right, they weren't hiding Pat Cummins off or anything like that. It's the complete opposite, really, of what India did all the way through. In this game of
in this final India only.
That's what I meant. When India had decisions to make, they went with the defensive options time and time again. I just don't think it's how you win. So my problem with the way that Australia played at the start of this tournament was Australia was basically playing in a way which was allowing the other team to do what they do and then Australia hoping what they did was slightly better, right? And when I talked to the Australian team, that was kind of one of the things I said. I said, you have to take wickets, right? You have to put pressure back on these other teams because when you were playing South Africa and New Zealand and England and Pakistan and India and, you know, all those really good teams, if you don't put pressure back on them, a lot of those players from those teams just go in autopilot, right? Yeah. If you don't put pressure on Mohamed Nawaz. Neither of us think Mohamed Nawaz, I can't believe I got his name right, but neither of us think Mohamed Nawaz is a great player. But if you don't put pressure on Mohamed Nawaz, he's going to get one for 45, right? Just on autopilot. He knows where to put the ball. He's a smart cricketer. You know, he's going to do that. If you don't put pressure on Mohamed Nawaz as the batter, he's going to get you 25 of 25 balls, right? That's one of the weaker players in all those teams I just mentioned.
Yeah.
And he has the skills to be able to do that. There is a sense that you have to beat these teams. And I think if you go back to South Africa, it's a real reason why South Africa has struggled at times as well. South Africa kind of let the game go and play it that way. Whereas if you go to Australia, you know, recent England, you know, Pakistan at their best, those are teams that just come at you, right? And, you know, you might still end up in a scrap and they might lose some games and everything else, but they come at you to win. I don't think India in the, you could almost say even the second half of that innings against New Zealand, I'm not sure that for the final three innings of this tournament, India did that. Yet for all the innings before that, that's how they were playing. They were coming at teams really, really hard. They were backing every single player, right? Mm. And then when it got push came to shove, they kind of lost a little bit of patience with maybe Siraj. Yadav wasn't bowling as well, so I wouldn't say they lost patience with him. And then they weren't as sure with Sky. And suddenly they were in this situation where they didn't trust their batting order because of Shami. All these things that shouldn't really have been an issue suddenly all became an issue. Yeah. And I do think a big part of that is this thing that keeps happening to them. And I don't know how to change it, because I thought after the last World Cup, that was it. Mm. Rahul Dravid and Rohit Sharma, the backroom staff, a lot of the players got together and they were like, this is it. We're not going to do this again. And then for 10 and a half games, they did exactly what they should have done. And then it reverted at the end. And if you go back and follow what I was saying at the start of the tournament, Bayram, I kept saying, and Cheyenne couldn't understand why I kept going on about this, right? Cheyenne, who works with us, obviously. Mm-hmm. I kept saying that my thing is that eventually I think they will revert. But even I stopped saying that, because Rohit had convinced me the way that he played that they were just going to keep going and keep going, right? And then suddenly it all fell apart.
To be fair to Rohit, he personally did keep going and he didn't let anything impact him.
I mean, you can't say it was him. Although, Jadeja still went in and Siraj didn't bowl. So even Rohit must have buckled at a certain point. You can't blame Dravid for both of those decisions, can you?
No. I mean, that's what I'm trying to say is that Rohit, the batter, was unfazed. But Rohit, the skipper, clearly, you know, it got to him because we, you know, in several podcasts and in pieces as well, we're talking about how India's role clarity is on point. Everyone understands their role to perfection and is executing it accordingly. And here you've messed with people's roles. You know, Shami is supposed to be first change. Siraj is supposed to be opening the bowling. That didn't happen. Jadeja got promoted. You know, you went a touch too slow in the middle, not looking for any boundary whatsoever, even twos, like you said. So the role clarity was all muddled as soon as pressure came into the picture. And like you said, they, you know, almost intrinsically reverted back to their defensive mode. And yeah, you could make a solid case that that did cost them the World Cup. And I don't know if you caught this tweet or not, but there was a Sky innings in the recent T20 that someone had said that, oh, look, Sky is all class. And I quote tweeted it with saying that, but can he do it on a dry afternoon in Ahmedabad? So that riled up like 10% of all of India. And no one understood the Stoke City pun. But Sky, of course, is undoubtedly an elite explosive player, right? We all know this. And he also copped a fair bit of criticism in this match because he was sluggish and couldn't really get bat on ball. And I think got one boundary in 7 attempts. How much of that was due to conditions? And how much of that was Australia actually using the conditions perfectly? Because those slower bounces by Josh Hazlewood, that was pretty much the perfect plan versus Sky.
I mean, it was. I just think Sky is such an incredible striker. So one of the reasons he's so impossible to face in T20 cricket is his ability to, every time he wants to hit a boundary, he almost hits a boundary. Hmm. And that's just not a normal thing that other players do, right? Like, you know, for some players, it can take like 2 and 3 boundary attempts to hit a boundary. Mm-hmm. And Sky, I think it's like 1.4 attempts for every boundary, right? Yeah. It's an incredible number. Mm-hmm. And if you look at one day cricket, I think it's like two He needs two attacking shots for one boundary. So again, running at a 50% ratio, which is for a one-day player, is incredible. He tried seven proper boundary attempts from what I saw and hit one boundary. Now, you're right. I think the slower ball bouncer played a part, but I think the pitch just played a part, right, by that point. And
yeah.
And so the one thing I would definitely, and to go back to the Sanjay's point, there's no doubt that that pitch played a big part in that. Of it was very, very hard to do that. I think we can all make many arguments that India could have put pressure on Australia in other ways that would have allowed them to at least still score more freely. But the fact that when Sky was trying to go, he still couldn't go, I think does tell you that the conditions are playing a much bigger part in that. Well, I mean, I looked it up before. I've now lost my thing. But his strike rate would have been one of the lower ones as well, right? Like, it wasn't like he had a great strike. Oh, it's right here.
I think he was 18 of 30, something like that.
Yeah, 18 of 28 with one boundary.
There right? we go.
So again... again, you had a player who wanted to hit the ball very hard, who couldn't. So I think that you have to actually, trust in that. The other thing is that, like, Mohammed Shami had a strike rate of 60 as well. Mm-hmm. Mohammed Shami is a dirty slogger, right? Like, he's a bloke who's trying to hit the ball very hard over and over again. And again, he struggled a little bit on that pitch. So I do think that it was tough, but Australia still bowled very well on that pitch and, as you said, came up with the right plans for the batters at each stage. And in some ways, Australia got an ideal pitch for, I mean, they'd probably rather have, a seeming pitch and have Hazelwood and Cummins go all over India. But they had an ideal pitch for that kind of, if we want to stop India scoring, that's a really, really good surface to do that. Because once those balls got soft, it became very, very hard. And because of India's propensity to gear back, and then the fact that they sent Jadeja in, maybe if Sky goes in when the spinners are bowling a little bit more or early on, he bats a little bit differently. But it was not an easy pitch, I think, to score on at that point, especially if you hadn't been in for very long. What did we say he faced? 28 balls. So he wasn't in for a huge amount of time either.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, no one's doubting that India got the worst of the conditions, particularly when it comes to batting. And another less talked about detail, which is also kind of related to the conditions, because, of course, dry conditions, bring about reverse swing. And Australia got some reverse swing, right? They extracted that. And basically, KL and Jadeja, both those wickets, were a result of the ball reverse swinging. And I think in this World Cup, we saw this on a fair few occasions and no one was expecting that, right? Everyone was thinking, oh, reverse swing in ODIs, that's dead. But we probably saw a lot more of it than we expected to in this entire World Cup.
Yeah, I think looking back, we probably had some occasions where we had this amount of reverse swing, which is not a lot, but it's enough, right?
Yeah.
But in other situations, the pitch was so good that you could put pressure back on the bowlers and it didn't destroy you. And I think what happens there is what happens in this particular situation is that they're not putting any pressure. So Australia is essentially bowling reverse swing like in a test match, right? They're bowling line and length reverse swing, and that causes the issue because you're not putting any pressure back. And that goes back to the thing we've talked about all the way through. But at the same time, I don't think Australia got a lot of reverse swing in this World Cup. I don't think Australia have got a lot of reverse swing since Sandpaper Gate, right? So I don't think it was one of the reasons Mitchell Stark, remember, in the middle of this tournament was like, we need to get rid of these two new balls. This is terrible, right? And then ends up reverse swinging the ball in the final. So even the Australians weren't really expecting that to happen and they probably got more. But I do think it was a combination of also just that they could bowl it on a good line of length without having any it's not like you could just punch it through the line a couple of times and get a four. Yeah. Or slog one away. Like, it wasn't that, well, they weren't in that sort of match situation. They certainly weren't in that kind of headspace and they weren't on that kind of pitch. So that three thing allowed Australia to probably bowl that whatever it was, five overs period where they went for it. And to be fair to Australia, again, talking about, there were people earlier in this World Cup laughing at Pat Cummins' captaincy and saying what a genius Rohit was. Pat Cummins got it exactly right. He bowled Mitchell Stark out quite early because he wanted those extra wickets and he wanted him to be bowling when the reverse swing was on. usually you would want Mitch Stark to probably bowl, you know, further into the death. And they, you know, and Pat Cummins backed himself to be able to do that job. So again, another like micro decision that he made that came off.
Yeah, a lot of his micro decisions came off. But also, you know, just the fact that the entire bowling attack turned up. Now, you and I, prior to the semifinals, I remember in Uncovered, was saying that Australia cannot win this World Cup just on the back of Adam Zampa, because they were heavily reliant on Zampa's leg spin in the round robin stage. And their pacers, minus Josh Hazlewood to a certain extent, just weren't, you know, existent. They were non-existent. And yeah, they were having a nightmarish World Cup, but come knockout games, they bring out their best. And yeah, it's just could not have timed it more perfectly, could they?
No. I think Zampa having a bad game in Australia winning this World Cup is actually quite sad for him, right? Because he'd been so good all the way through. And
you know, I mean, finally, 1 for 46 is not a bad game.
No, but I mean, when you've taken 48,000 wickets in the rest of the World Cup. Like, put it this way, he's not going to get a lot of credit for the actual win, whereas actually it was his form that carried them through so effortlessly at times. But you're right. Again, this is the first time that all three seam bowlers, frontline seam bowlers, bowl well in the same game. And it tells you that how many things had to come against India for that to happen.
Basically.
Because even in the previous game, certainly Cummins went for runs, but I think Stark might have.
He got a three-for. He got a three-for in the semi and a three-for in the final.
No, he got three-for. But did he go for runs in that game? Or was it Hazlewood that went for runs? I can't remember.
I think it was Hazlewood even that went for runs in that game.
Yeah, but so even in that game, Hazlewood wasn't particularly good, right? So you go through all the way, and it just was Australia never had a situation where all their bowlers were on top at the same time. And as you said, Zampa was fine, right? In a low-scoring game, his figures are probably not spectacular, but he wasn't terrible. But yeah, it was Cummins, wasn't it? So yeah, Cummins in the semi-final, he took three wickets, but went at over fives in a game where the score was like 212, right? So, you know, and Zampa also went for runs in that game against South Africa. So this is the first time when all four of their bowlers didn't go for any runs at all four of their frontliners, and that the three seamers all were good on the same day. And I mean, what do you do about that? Cummins had as you said at the start, Cummins had a shit World Cup, and then suddenly he was great.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the whole final holistically, you know, India go off to flyer, and then Australia get those quick wickets, right? They've got three wickets at 80 runs, and they've basically executed that plan, got Iyer quickly. They have India where they want them, and now India going at snail's pace, and Australia restrict them to 240 odd bowlers, have a field day, all of that. Then Travis Head plays a blinder. And, you know, the Evan Gulbis effect and all of that, of course, is a major bit. But the point is that so many things had to happen in unison for India to botch this World Cup final in Australia, to pull off the one of the greatest heists we've seen in World Cup cricket, at least in World Cup cricket finals, right? So, I mean, how freaky is it? It is quite freaky. You think of it, you know, this was India's cup. Australia run away with it. And just all of these things happening together, combining, it's crazy.
I think that's what I wanted to talk about was if you're just talking about choking, or even to go back to the Sanjay thing we keep bringing up, if you're just talking about choking all the pitches, you're kind of missing the amount of things that went against India.
Yeah,
in this particular situation. And that's probably that's the only way to beat a team this good, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and even within that, what, 65% of the way through this game, they were still favourites.
I mean, right? They had Australia at 47 for three, WinWiz had them at what, 52%, I think, India?
Yeah, you know, they looked like, I mean, I would have had them even higher at that stage. Mm-hmm. Travis Head looked like he was going to get bowled almost any minute, right?
Yeah.
And, but all these things had to happen in order for Australia to win. The pitch had to be easier to time the ball when Australia batted, right? Mm-hmm. All those micro decisions we talked about before, all the errors that India made, all this, it's too easy to say they choked. Yeah. It's much better to say they made a series of bad decisions and that Australia played an absolute blinder of a game. This was Australia's best game of the tournament by a long distance. They did not look this good against South Africa in the semi-final. Even some of those other wins, you know, the New Zealand win and everything else, they did not look this good.
Yeah.
Everything came together so perfectly for this particular win. And it was absolutely, you know, brilliant from that perspective. I just don't like the reductionist arguments. And I understand this. You know, the kind of stuff we do here, Bayram, is not for everyone, right?
Yeah.
But if you want to find the hot takes and you want the people who are just going to say, India bottled it, right? There's plenty of places out to find that. I just found this a really fascinating thing of how does a team as good as India lose? And when you start to look at all the individual details, it's actually incredibly fascinating. And, you know, if you're an Indian fan, you may not give a shit about any of that at the moment, and that's fair. But maybe one day someone will find this artifact of our incredibly long chat and they'll go, oh, okay, it was a bit deeper than just choking.
Absolutely. And we kind of broke it down for you guys on how did they lose that. But you let us know in the comments what you think was the biggest factor in India basically losing that World Cup final. But that's it for this podcast. Thank you guys for tuning in. And we'll be back with another episode of Footmarks for you next week. For now, that is all. Have a good one. Enjoy.
Thanks for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are many other extras as well, including a Discord channel. There's a link to those in the show notes. Please review, subscribe, and tell all your friends about our show. Word of mouth is the best way of making our podcast grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bharat Sundaresan and Bayram Kazi. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston. Each episode is produced by Ishit Kuberka at Sound Potion Studio. The team from 42 help us out with the video side. Orajoti Sainapayan and Maida Akam, both producing podcasts, while Mukunda Bandreddy is the head of our YouTube content. If you are a podcaster who happens to waffle on and you need a way to cut down your long-form content, Memento FM is here to save the day. They turn your lengthy media into bite-sized chunks for even the most time-starved audience. Start using Memento FM today.